Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Welcome to the After Things podcast. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Brian Brushwood.
It's true.
Justin Robert Young.
Hey, friends, it's me.
So let's start off with on After Things. One of the things we like to do is people sometimes send us questions or send us some things that they've been thinking about and want us to weigh in with our thoughts on it. And again, we are not professional business advisors, and we'll just weigh in. Just think of us as just a couple of buddies you're going to run an idea by, and we'll give you our thoughts. Don't give it too much weight, really, because we could just lead you to bankruptcy and living out of your car and having to use your body to make money. And then maybe that's what you want to do. That's fine. But just understand, you know, we're just a couple of guys. So this is from Kaiva, who writes, big fan of the show, you guys. My question is about choosing when to stop making money from a book or other writing you self-publish. We all like to think our works will take off in a literary lottery and hold on to all our rights, reserve copyrights as if that will happen one day, launching our fortune. But ultimately, we just want the legacy of our work immortalizing us out there for everyone to read. With that in mind, I came across unglue.it and wonder what your thoughts are on it. Would you ever decide to do that? And will Andrew's author page project look similar to help authors win and switch off their revenue for publications that have reached a chosen earnings target and change license to a Creative Commons one? Thanks, Kaiva. So, the question is what Unglue is you can basically say, hey, I have a book or I have a series or whatever, and I'm just going to turn this over into a kind of the Creative Commons will kind of generalize that as a public domain, which Creative Commons has, you know, sort of a little bit different than that, but essentially the same idea that, you know, people can take, read it, have access to it, whatever. And so that's what the purpose of Unglue is. I think I'll start off by saying I think it's a very interesting idea. I think it can be a very useful idea. I think that part of the advantage of the Creative Commons, as you know, was sort of a right structure in which you can turn over rights to let other people remix and use it under different kinds of licenses. And it's a way to sort of free things up outside of the conventional, just I have a copyright, only I can do it, and allows you to sort of let these things continue on. You can either say, hey, I need attribution, I don't need, or whatever. I think it's a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful concept in a world in which we're creating so much content and we'd hate to see certain things get tied up or you're not able to know what you can do with that. And I would say even the discussion about these things has sort of changed considerably over the last 10 years. And, you know, a lot of things that, you know, you would have been eager to put copyrights onto, you don't necessarily, partially because you realize they don't really have much value after the fact. Also because you realize, man, there's more value if people can share it. So to answer the question of like, could I see author page becoming a place where people could continue and put stuff out there? Certainly. Like right now on authorpage.com, we have the ability, you can put up short stories and you can say to people, hey, this is copyright free, whatever CC license, and let people share it with it. And you can make that available. We want to enable people to upload books and stuff. And I certainly think enabling people to do that, I know that in my own life, there are things in which I'm eager to protect and sort of because I continue to make money from books that I wrote 20 years ago. But I have other things I've written that I just want to get out there. And that becomes sort of that line where you want to sort of figure out where things are. Like my book, How to Make Money on Mars, I just kind of really want to get this thing out there. I'm not really going to try to like push this like I would one of my other books. So I think that there's value to both.
So my question is that baked into their question is the supposition that the moment you put something on Unglue It, you cease to make money on it. And I want to question that thesis because it seems like we already exist in a world where if somebody wants your work for free, they can get it for free via BitTorrent or whatever. It's only by the graciousness of you know, or I don't know, professional courtesy or whatever, that people bother to buy books and send you a check for it. So I almost wonder, like, let's assume both of our collective back catalog was instantly on Unglue It. I don't know that would significantly impact our...
Can I explain how Unglue It works, though?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, so Unglue It works a little bit differently. So you say, and I don't I don't know about this model. So, but the Incluit can say, hey, if we raise X amount of dollars, I will take this property and I will make it available for everybody, right? So if you say, okay, I'm going to take, you know, my Brian Brushwood, Justin Robert Young, Norse Viking Saga series and say, it's super popular. Like, yeah, I would like to make this available for anybody to download to have whatever. If we raise $5,000, I will give up this and it will become part of that. Okay. That's one model. Another model is that I'm going to sell it through Unglue It. And when we've sold X number of copies, it will then become available. Third one is, yeah, it's RDCC. I just want to make it available here, whatever, you know, and people can pay whatever they want for the license in the ebook. So it's a different thing. And I probably miscategorized it initially as far as what specifically it was doing. So I don't know about this model. I really, because I think that you're still driving people to, I kind of think you'd either decide I'm ready to turn this over or not. I don't know if this makes it really that much better.
Yeah, I'm curious to see, you know, there are certain communities for which you can benefit from that gesture of goodwill. And I think having a easier pipeline to do it is good. But I don't know. I mean, you know, we are all certainly living examples of the idea of talking to niche communities, right? And there should be as many ways to make money and be happy writing and selling ebooks as there are communities that would like to buy them, you know? And I think that there are general best practices, but you know, look at like Reddit, for example. Reddit and many of their subreddits abhors the idea that you are selling them something, right?
Or even now, that you personally created a thing. It's like it's offensive to them if you're like,
sure,
hi,
sure.
I made this.
And that's certainly a part of the same philosophy, right? But like if we're just to draw a circle around money,
sure,
they
sure.
They have a weird thing about money, right? But theoretically, it could be a more palatable thing if you're like, hey, look, I took these hours from doing it. I paid this amount for someone to do the cover. I'm literally just looking to recoup. And now I have a way that I can show you, a face up. This is what I've spent. And I want to make this free. I just don't want to, I want to be able to make my rent. So this is how I'm doing it. That might be more interesting to a community that is weird about anybody shilling anything and certainly anybody making money on anything. So, like, you know, who knows?
I mean, there's my own thoughts on it. And then there's sort of like what I think the perceptual problems are with it. And one, it's like you still have to drive people to it and make them aware of this thing. And it's sort of like if something reaches its end of marketing life, I don't think there's going to be any life for it here. You know, I don't think there's really like now I'm going to, if you guys let me do this, I think the amount of energy and effort you put into it to try to drive attention will never be rewarded by the amount of money or revenue that it generates. I kind of think that once you're done with Amazon and your own marketing efforts and everything else, and you think that the book has reached its end of life, its marketing life and, you know, whatever, then make it CC, you know, make it a Creative Commons available. Cause I think then trying to find this other aftermarket by getting people to subsidize, turning it into that doesn't make sense to me.
Yeah, it's got an inherent problem where insofar as if you are passionate about this thing, then you're probably on the team, you've already paid for it. So if you're that consumer, why would you want to buy it again under a different platform with the goal of making it free for other people? Because like I don't mind knowing that every time I recommend Patrick Rothfuss's Name of the Wind, that Patrick Rothfuss is going to make money. In fact, I rather love that. And in fact, I part of the reason I recommend it is because I know that he's going to make more money for it. This does seem to kind of undercut that whole business model, right?
Yeah, I don't know that we need that. And again, I'm happy to be proven wrong on this. Let me make it very, very clear. And I don't want to be like, I'm just my own understanding of it. And I may be mistaken is that like, I can under Kickstarter right now, I could put out a Kickstarter project and say, hey, if we do X number of these, then we'll make it available, whatever. I think trying to create a separate sort of system to do this, because I still have to do everything I have to do with the Kickstarter. I have to drive people into it. I have to get people, pledge people to it, et cetera. And that's challenging. And people are trying to find a lot of different ways in which to do crowdfunding and publishing. And it all comes down to, you know, it still comes down you're going to have a successful crowdfunding publishing campaign, probably for the same reason you'll have a successful traditional publishing campaign. If you can drive people to your book, you can drive people to your book.
Right.
Yeah.
So I guess our answer is sure, in theory, but in practice, I guess we're not seeing a lot of opportunity here.
Let me put this out there then. What do we label this? Is this Creative Commons? Do we release this as Creative Commons? Weird things?
I don't think we do. I think technically we've never.
Right. We've never made that decision, which means that by default, it's under traditional copyright.
Yeah.
And we will strictly enforce those copyrights.
Exactly.
But
some later date, if we ever cared, and not really. please. Say, we'll do whatever you want.
Let's say that, we had a level on Patreon that was like, hey, if we don't hit this, we're just not going to do the show. Right?
Yeah.
Like, we are taking money on a weekly basis to put out something that is free of charge for other people. And if we had made the decision to release it Creative Commons, then it would be, free to be remixed or retransmitted for other people, right? Based on the limits we want to put on that. So, I guess on some level, we're kind of doing something similar here. The only difference is that we're not emphasizing the and it's free for everybody, right?
Yeah, one of the things, I'm a big fan overall of the concept of Creative Commons. And I would say that, but a lot of times, though, from the copyleft thing, I think that some of the copyleft sort of ignores that some of the people that benefit the biggest in some of those scenarios they have, if you get rid of certain kinds of copyright, isn't the individual consumers, as sometimes it's the bigger companies. Barnes & Noble makes, Barnes & Noble puts out these big fancy editions of classic works and things like that. And companies like Barnes & Noble and Amazon, would love to not have to pay the royalties they do. They would love for the fact to be in a system where they don't have to do that. And in one hand, we imagine these things empowering people at the bottom. But the other hand is it also these sort of copyrights and stuff help the little guy deal with the big guy, and help you sort of have some sort of ability to claim rights and where you can repurpose this. And my biggest fear in some Creative Commons scenarios is that you can see your stuff, your content taken out, put somewhere on some other podcast network, and then your commercials stripped out, other commercials put in place and whatever, and you lose control, which might be fine. There's different licenses for that, but I'm saying a lot of times people argue why have them at all? It's like, well, once you get rid of any kind of artist rights, it doesn't obviously necessarily benefit the people you think it will.
Yeah. Strengths points out that there is a no commercial CC license. You could, that's one of the benefits of Creative Commons is that you get to designate the do's and do not.
Oh yeah. No. Yeah. I was thinking more in general, the idea of why do we have it at all? And often it's in the idea is it's these laws are there just to protect the big companies. Sometimes some companies just want to be carriers of content. If they don't have to pay for content, works even better, because they own the pipe. And so, yeah, there's a variety of Creative Commons licenses and stuff. So there's different ways in which you can use that. And I'm all for us embracing something that makes sense. Anybody even cared.
To bring it back to unglue it, it seems like one of the other things that they're touting is that when they put out a book, it is on a no DRM format. Do you guys think that there's much value in that compared to something like where music people regularly want to reuse stuff, video where people want to regularly reuse stuff, where just ease of consumption might be an element of this?
I generally, I think whenever I can on it, Amazon gives you the option when you put your books there to not do any kind of copy protection on it. When I put out my eBooks in EPUB format, I don't do it because I'm... If you want to be able to get a version of it, you can. And I've been frustrated in dealing with my publishers sometimes because they use these platforms for ebook distribution or whatever. That I'm like, why are we using this? It's a pain in the ass. You're losing people at every step. We got to have copy production. I'm like, that's a joke. It doesn't work. I can show you how to get around this in 10 seconds, and it's counter to our purposes of promoting the book. And I think that. People, I've dealt with people in corporate environments who are under the delusion, well, we copy protected it. Well, yeah, but it doesn't work. And yeah. all you were doing is making it harder.
Right. But what when they say, but we copy protected it, what they mean is our jobs are secure because we can't be the ones found, you know, left holding the bag. We did
yeah.
a thing.
Yeah. Oh, I think that they, but also it's a naivete. I've encountered this before. They don't understand. They imagine that like, yeah, maybe somebody really wanted to like, no, there's like there are people that as soon as they get something to library, it automatically happens thousands of copies at a time. That they just have no grasp of it. And I think you're absolutely right. That's part of that, but also just a lack of, I remember talking to somebody, I remember it was Sean Fanning had this thing, was like project was like Snowball or whatever like this was post Napster. And he was developing a system that was supposed to be able to scan, like if you were AT&T would be able to scan if copyrighted, if like MP3s and stuff that were under some sort of copyright protection were being sent through the pipeline, you know, and that way they could like say, hey, you need to pay your license on this, whatever. And I talked to somebody a company was investing in this. And I said, this is ludicrous. He said, that technology won't work. I said, oh, what do you mean? I said, because all I have to do is just change the way in which that MP3 is encoded, you know, the zip format or whatever, it will never detect it. He's like, oh no, they have a way around. I'm like, dude, if they've got a way around this, they should be selling it to the goddamn NSA because that's technically impossible to do that, you know? But it's just that desire, and this is going back 15 years ago, 10, 12 years ago, the desire to believe that, oh yeah, now we found a way to get around how those hackers are getting into this. We have the system we can put in place. And we'll know every single one of these songs that's going through the system was just delusional.
Yeah, it's just something that you could sell on contract to a gigantic company that'll make
yeah and that's the way that might have been the really big thing. It might have been another scam, you know, like here's how I scammed the music companies again. You know, first I invent Napster, now I sell them a technology and the promise,
the antidote,
we'll be able to get those people,
because who could stop Napster but the guy who made Napster, like, oh, here, take it.
Yeah, so quick question for you guys, off topic but still related.
Yeah.
Smartest thing you've done recently, one of the smartest things you think you've done recently. Let's start with the dumbest thing you've done in the last few years and then the smartest thing you've done. Okay. And I'll start off, like, I would say dumbest thing I've done is I continuously plan for the next 6 months, but not the next 5 years financially, everything like that. I put so many things off in the sense like I will settle this later on. And then I find myself in a situation going, I just keep pushing that further down the line. You know, like I live in Florida, I have a place in LA, I've been in back and forth here for several years now. I should probably commit, and my life would be much more streamlined if I did that. But I keep pushing that off to, I'll make that decision later on.
Yeah, I would say the dumbest thing I've done, maybe in my entire adult business life, was purchase an ad in the Yellow Pages. The thinking at the time was, okay, I know everything's going to Google, but we're not there yet. There are somewhere out there is some corporate client that wants to book for a Christmas party, and they're just going to open up the Yellow Pages and dial the first number they see. So I took out a fancy Yellow Pages ad that said, you know, Brian Brush and Magic as seen on The Tonight Show, whatever. To date, and because of the commitments, you had to run it for an entire year or whatever, like, not one valid business lead came from it. And as a result of running it, my cell phone is now like on a billion, business lists. So I get phone calls from, you know, spammers all the time, you know, hey, may I speak to the owner of the business? You know, and immediately I know that they're about to sell me on some kind of merchant solutions, blah, 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 blah. Worst decision I ever made.
I would say, you know, the first thing that pops into my head, the worst decision that I've made in the last few years was, overpaying for the Contender and overbuying for the Contender. And really that was more of a symptom of not having a full enough idea of the full chain of business, you know, and it's always been easy for me. I mean, number one, if you're not a like top down entrepreneur, it's not a lesson that you ever really learn, you know, like you are always part of a team and your goal is to specialize at the thing that you are good at and to let everybody else who's a part of your team do the best. And maybe if you see little connective tissue here and there that needs repairing, you can go ahead and do it. But stay in your lane. Everybody, if everybody rows as hard as they can in the right direction, then everybody will be successful. And then even when I've worked in smaller businesses with Andrew and other people, you know, it's I allowed myself to fall into the like soft, sweet cocoon of like, oh, that's another person's job, right? And no, it'd be rude for me to you know bug in and kind of look over things again, or maybe take up more of their responsibility, and not realizing that ultimately, especially in a small company, if you are not double checking everything, and it doesn't mean you have to be a dick about it, but like if you're not asking why at every possible option, or not thinking, especially when it comes to the big decisions, like, can we be smarter about this? Is there somebody else that I can call about this? Is there another thing that you can do? Like, then that's where you get into the regret phase. And ultimately with the Contender, we hilariously overbought and we spent too much money. And, you know, that's a reason why, thankfully, the debate expansion things have pretty much, you know, we're going to see how everything shakes out, but we'll hopefully be in the black for the first time on this project since it started, which should not have been the case for something that raised $140,000.
I will defend your decision. Although, I mean, at the time, like, I was surprised that you decided to go bigger and go to that. Cause I'm always err on the side of caution. I'm like, you know, do as small of a run as you can, pay for that, then figure things out. But I don't think it was a dumb decision. I think that in retrospect, I would say Brian knew buying a phone book ad, dumb. Brian knows this. You know, Brian was hopeful, but he knew the evidence was like, this is not where the world is going. It was just a risky thing, right?
Sure.
You know, yeah. And I would say that, like, for me, like, I have, like, in some ways I'm extremely cautious, worked very well, but some kinds of planning I am not good and dumb in the sense that, like, you know, I rent an apartment in LA. I have a house in Florida. I should probably only have one because, you know, I should probably figure out one because it's not like, oh, yeah, my vacation place in Florida. No, I watch it on drop cam and I worry about when hurricanes go through, you know. And I think about those things where I will keep things going on much longer than I should because I don't want to it's the same reason why I can't manage a large business at this point, because I don't want to worry about the details. I want to focus on the future. And I think that I'm gonna use an example here, and I'm gonna evoke the name of Elon Musk. One of the things that's fascinating about him to me is that when the production lines for Tesla were starting to slip, he literally made his bed at the Tesla factory, so he could focus on everything. And you'd watch him when they do interviews. Like, I just watched, he did some interview with like Khan Academy or something like that. I'm like, oh, what, you know, like, so what was your problem? He says, oh, today, literally the problem was that we had to stop the entire production line because we were missing one $3 USB cable that did not make its way from China. So we had everybody going to every single Fry's to find these things. And what you talk about, Justin, there is the idea of when you just worry about one part of the problem, is that many CEOs would be like, you know, they think that they'll be their leaders when they're like, all right, you guys go solve it. And because I said solve it, I'm being a leader. Where yeah. He's actually on the ground going like, where do we get these things? Because nobody has as much invested. Nobody cares as much as he does. And ideally, he shouldn't have to solve those problems. But if he decides, hey, I'm the leader, I did my part, you know, if the team drops the ball, it's their fault, not mine. That's not big picture.
Well, yeah. And let me clarify. When I say, you know, what happened with the Contender was dumb, I don't mean that in a way that like it was necessarily avoidable. Like, it's in hindsight avoidable, and I think we made those decisions for all the right reasons. However, it to me was kind of a burning your hand on the stove moment. And it's like, mm-hmm. when you first burn your hand on the stove when you're a kid, you just don't, you know, for whatever reason, that's just a thing that seems like a cool thing, and then you realize it's not, and so you get better. So it's like, you know, I think it can become dangerous for me to beat myself up about it, right? But I think it's healthy for me to let it kind of loom there as this mythological sort of mistake that you want to avoid. Just make it my little boogeyman whenever I want to get lazy with a big decision coming up and be like, you know, I don't know. It just seems, numbers seem right. Let's move on. Like, I want that boogeyman in the corner just to be like, you know, are you sure?
Well, one of the worst things I ever did was there was a contract for a show that under time it just said TBD, and I never got around to following up or double checking on it. And I remember waking up at the crack of 10:30 in the morning and getting a phone call from the booker conveying the message from the college that, the show's in 90 minutes. Are you going to be there? And then I realized it was a noontime show and not an evening show. And it was one of the most panicked moments I ever had. And, we raced down there and it was too late for us to do the show. And so instead we rescheduled, but I felt so bad about it that the very act of having such a disaster built into me, per your hot stove analogy, this low-grade paranoia at all times about, like, double check the time,
yeah,
because it was so painful to not show up there that it was never an issue again.
I will show up sometimes on conference calls like a week early because I was so afraid of missing it that I like, oh my god, I go like, oh wait, no, that's not until next week. In California, there was a LA Times article about how the pension fund, the state pension fund, 10 years ago when, 10, 12 years ago, like the economy, 15 years ago when the economy was going through like its boom period, they made these obligations, these promises to pay into the pension fund based upon the most rosy expectations you could have. And they only spent about 20 minutes listening to somebody explain, well, here's the downside if the economy does not continue this miraculous continuous upsweep to it. And now the California state is on the line for like $500 billion or more and probably going, because the people who made this decision maybe there's that downside. They didn't want it. They spent less time listening to the downside, and they go after they talk to them now and they're all like, yeah, we regret that. Yeah. You know? And it's like, and that's the thing that's scary, is that these people have had because they didn't want to spend an extra hour to listen to, what was going on. Listen to like somebody say, no, here's the downside of this, because they didn't address that. They didn't acknowledge that $500 billion or more is just gone, effectively gone, because of like prompt obligations they've made or whatever. And that's scary. And that has to deal with, it's why I'm afraid of any bureaucracy, whether it be large corporations or governments or whatever, is because sometimes people, the relationship between their decisions and the outcome is so disconnected. You know, for those people, there's no punishment. They get an article that criticizes them, and that's it. That's all that happens. We scream, yeah, to cut off the heads of people on Wall Street who do dumb things. But when people do this in this scale in another venue, we're like, nobody even knows their names. And I think bringing that down to sort of the small business point of view is like, I look at my own business and stuff and how things, I'm like, I'll pay this much for labels. I'll just wait till next week to do it. And then like, maybe I'll have to pay $300 or $400 more in shipping to have this delivered. And then it's like, because I'm lazy and I don't want to make the decision now, I don't want to get the evidence now, it costs me later on.
I'll tell you what, man, this is why it matters so much who you get on your team. And I'm very, very thrilled and proud to say that, right now I feel like we've hit the lottery between Bryce and Brant and John. We're able to, we have different core competencies. We're all able to support each other. I know that John, as much as Justin gives him a hard time for being Dutch as hell, a side effect of that is that
whoa,
I know.
Whoa! How do I get singled out? Don't act like you're not making the jokes.
Well, no, he's very mindful of prices, right? He's very detail oriented. I never put the connection with Dutch.
Don't act like I'm the only one making John's Dutch joke, that John's cheap.
but it works and it matters because it allows us to do things. And I know, I do my due diligence and I ask, kind of see the numbers, but I always feel dumb afterwards because it's clear that he's thought about everything that I could think of ahead of time, right? But it's like when you have people who, their strengths, then it makes a big difference.
So, okay, so we'll put that into, would you say that was one of your smartest decisions?
Oh,
was
easily.
That
yeah, yeah, no. I would say that by and large, the folks that we have brought into the team, and by the way, that goes to present company included as far as co-hosts and so on, I would say the smartest thing I've ever done is surround myself with talented, talented people who are experts in their fields.
Justin? And thank you,
Brian. Smartest thing in business that I ever...
Or just in general.
Yeah, well, I mean, but this is I think kind of related to it. Like, I first learned this with the Go Game, and I've learned it a lot more. We just had this big thing with the Contender, right? So I tried to go through the thought exercise of it's not what you say, it's what they hear, right? And in business, that's very often it's not what your problems are, it's what their expectations are, your customers. And like, this has just been a general fascination for me, is just communication, right? Like, where does communication break down? Where do, when two people start arguing and they both believe that they are absolutely in the right and the other person is completely unreasonable and they're both good people, where does that static happen? And so with the Go Game, there was this big rush when I was there to develop new games, right? But the new games that always wound up getting developed were different ways that you could use the Legos that we knew we had on the back end to create new complexities there, right? But for people who by and large were buying the product, they didn't know that we had all those Legos. They only know what we show them. They only know what is going on when they play the game itself. So it's like we wound up overcomplicating a lot of stuff. Things would break. Things were harder to run when you weren't the person doing it. And ultimately, I don't think it really made that much better of a product. For the Contender, we overbought, right? So we've got every time that there were two sources of despair with the Contender team. When we looked at the bank account and when we looked at the gigantic pile of boxes, right? So everything wanted, all the solutions that we initially wanted to come up with were about those two things. Let's make more money while we sell more boxes. And that's noble. That's great. And that ultimately shows that we can move, you know, that's the greater success that we want. However, we need to solve one quickly, because we still owe money to our manufacturer, and that's the money thing. And ultimately what we had to realize, and we did, thankfully, with, you know, in time for the debates, was that we needed to talk to our customers. And we had thankfully people like the game, but they want more cards. They've played the game five or six times. It's, you know, loses a little luster when everybody's read the things. They just want more. And so we had to shift a little bit and say, hey, look, let's sell to our base. Let's sell to the people that have already bought the game, because they will give us more money for more content. Now, that is counterintuitive to the problem that we know of having a gigantic pile of games in a warehouse, right? But ultimately, it moved a little bit, a few more games, you know, a few more base decks, and it just gets people out there playing the games with their friends, and ultimately that kind of moves things forward. But it was counterintuitive to what we thought was solving our main problem, and that's probably the biggest thing that I've had to like stop myself to rethink an idea, to be like, how does this talk to, like, again, it doesn't matter what I'm saying, it matters what they expect and what they're hearing and how we react to it, and you know, and that's life and business.
You know, and these sort of things are like they're common things. You know, there's a sunk cost fallacy, which you're very, very well aware of, and there's your best customer is an existing customer. You know, those are things that we know, but when you get obsessed with like not knowing what the problem was, like when I decided, like, you know, we had a warehouse in Florida where we'd been running our iTrix business out of, and I had, you know, thousands of DVDs. And I made the decision that even though I'd made money, like made my money back on all of them, but I was already shifting my distribution model to using an online company to like do my order fulfillment, which cost me more per unit, but ultimately we figure out factor in time and shipping anything else was about the same. I made the decision to landfill thousands of DVDs, thousands of Magic DVDs, because I said, you know what, I can look at this and say, man, I've got $20,000 of merchandise in here, but it's like, well, yeah, but I'm paying, you know, $500-$600 a month in warehouse fees. I've got to go into the warehouse and go do it. Yet, you know, it made more sense to me just to destroy those. And that's hard. I mean, somebody mentioned in the chat, like they've got a closet full of these decks, and we perceive that as having value, but we kind of ignore how much value it's costing us, the expense of that. And you have your goal of your business to make money. And like you realize with like the contender, like you had to step away from the goal is not to sell these units. The goal is the contender enterprise to make money. And yes. How do you do that? Like, oh, you sell the new thing. And in what some ways it's counterintuitive, but other ways it's kind of obvious.
Yeah. But it's breaking yourself out of your linear thought pattern. Right. Mm-hmm. And that's hard.
Especially it's hard
to do.
We're all primed to evaluate where we are and what direction we're headed in terms of the context of what brought us to this moment, right? So it's like that's the heuristic we rely upon is, hi, I'm looking at a warehouse and it's got a whole bunch of DVDs. How did I get here? Well, because past me thought that these would all sell by this time and so on. Therefore, I have to continue the journey that past me initiated and try to sell these. And same thing with overbuying on Contender. And God knows there's been plenty of stuff as we've done scam stuff that I've overbought on. And you can't ever know. And it turns out that instead you have to look at the way things are. Not that you need to, you know, be panicked and overreact one way or the other, but it certainly makes a difference when you realize that past you was buying the option of what if this runs off, not necessarily predicting this is definitely inevitable and this is what has to happen. And instead, current you is now in the position to decide to take advantage of the option that you bought or not. And oftentimes it makes sense to not take advantage of it.
And you're in a position where, like, Bri, you're putting out something pretty much new every month. And so you know that, okay, you know, I can only do so much market research to figure out what the total market for one product is. But you know that if 3 out of 5 succeed, you're doing really well.
Right.
You know, and if your coverage on the other
highly diversified.
Two,
yeah, absolutely.
What's that? Yeah. And that's a problem. I think a lot of times people, you know, they kind of overlook is like, we've run into this in Magic all the time is I've known people who suffered immense financial hardships because they spend $20,000 or $30,000 on a product that probably had negligible market potential to begin with, but they were so obsessed with the idea that this would be there. And then they sit on top of this inventory and like, oh, no, they're like, oh yeah, no, I made money eventually, you know, because I eventually sold it. It's like, well, did you really like over time? And like, when I say like, my Magic stuff made money, like, no, I mean like in the first 18 months, we made back our money plus that. Our time, it's hard to know what our time is worth, but it's hard. But I know that I've always been super cautious. Like I don't do, I mean, I love things like I have my new effect plug, the device out, which I like this because I can go to an on-demand printer. I can have it printed nicely, nice cardstock, whatever. But I've shipped, you know, 500 copies off to my wholesaler, but like I have in possession myself, maybe 30 or 40 copies. So if I do another email campaign, I got to order more before I can do that.
Right.
So I'm super cautious, probably to the point that I limit myself.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think part of it is understanding your field. And that's something that we did not, at the point that we did the game. But you know, I think there's a million different ways to skin a cat and, you know, just realizing, you know, a part of this is just experience, right? Mm-hmm. Part of this is just understanding how it goes and then moving forward.
So that was, could you sum up again the smart thing you did?
Smartest thing I did was break myself of thinking about what my problem was and start thinking about what the customer's problem was.
Good point. Very good point.
What about you?
You know, I still feel like I'm learning lessons and hard lessons, and I have to look back and go, when did things work? Not because of design, but because of things that happened. And the best things that I think that have happened in my life have come from when other people have helped me because I helped them when there was nothing in it for me. You know, from publishing to TV to other things, the things that have happened there have been people who've said, hey, I'm going to go out and help him make this thing happen because he was there when I needed him. You know, he was there and we needed his help and I didn't ask for anything for that, you know? So I would say that, and knowing that now I have a project, an ongoing, a kind of a longer term next year sort of project. I'm in my networking phase right now, going out, helping other people and doing things for them. So when I'm ready to take this to its next step, the first time people see me or hear from me isn't when I'm asking them for something.
Yeah, and dude, that is such an important point. Like you have to build value before you can cash it out to ask people to, whether it's take action, participate in a survey, buy your gizmo, vote for your whatever. It's like, you got to build that value up.
It's frustrating. Cause like I've had examples of that, of like people who've like, you know, I'd reached out to you before, not for anything, but like somebody said, oh, we should connect or whatever. And they're like, yeah, yeah. And then a year later I get an ask. They never followed through. They never followed through on something. And then a year later, they're asking me for a favor or whatever. I've had that happen repeatedly where it's like, hey, remember when we were going to get together and talk to see if we like each other and help each other out? And you decided that I wasn't worth your time. Now you're coming to me and you're asking me for something. I have other people who I'd rather give my time to, you know? And I think that's one of the challenges, I think, for a lot of people, is just that, you know, when I go to startup stuff and other things, is there are a lot of people asking for things, not a lot of people trying to give things, you know, and give things means let me know what I can do to help. Like, hey, and I've tried to do that, like, you know, with you know, some of those things I talk to people like, oh, that's a great idea. Let me go introduce you to so-and-so from somebody I could not conceivably ever need anything from, but I want to be in the habit of introducing people, helping people out and saying, because I know the more I get experienced in connecting other people and understanding the needs of other people, I'll be better at handling my own. But also, it just feels good.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's nothing better than sharing success and being an uncredited part of somebody else's. If you can make that something that makes you happy, like, you know, wire yourself that, or you are wired like that, man, world's so much easier.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a very good key point there, Justin, is the idea of wiring yourself to like enjoy the success of others. And you know, coming from the magic background where people are often just so jealous of anybody
so
that succeeds.
So short-sighted. And by the way, and I've said this before, I have you two to thank for breaking me of that small-minded mentality, that idea that somehow because David Blaine was super popular, that in any way would rob me of opportunity, and instead, you know, realize the opposite is that the more popular David Blaine is, the more people are interested in magic, and the more people want to hire awesome magicians at their holiday parties, or, you know, buy books of magic or watch magic related video series and so on.
Yeah, and I want to live in a universe where hard work and talent succeed. And some people succeed not because of talent, because of hard work. Some people succeed because of talent, not hard work. You know, I like to think that's the world we live in. And I often I'll have people like, well, what do you think of so-and-so, this person, man, magic, and expecting I'm going to trash on them. And I'm like, no, I'll tell you what's great about them. I'll tell you what's really smart. They did this, they did that. Like, I respect that, you know. They earned it. You know, they worked hard for it. And there's this mentality. A lot of people like to think that it's just happenstance. Somebody hit the lottery and that's it. Where I, maybe naively, but I really believe that hard work really underlies a lot of success. And sometimes the less talented person, the more hard work they needed. Some people get flash in the pan opportunities, but it's not sustainable. And I'm in awe of all sorts of successful people, and I'm always constantly trying to learn from that.
And dude, it is one of those things where it's like when success comes, hope it comes slowly. Hope it comes over time. Hope it comes as the result of measurable hard work that you did so that you can adjust to it. Because when people get too much too fast, that's when they go insane, and that's where the tragic tales come from.
Yeah, and you exactly knowing why things worked is critical. And you hear these sort of, you can tell the difference. I can tell the difference between somebody who's a good businessman and not based on all of them will attribute luck as to some factor. But some of them, I think the better ones have this, you know, you've really got to keep when everybody else thinks it sucks, when everybody else has left it, you've got to be the one making it work. You've got to be the one that fights for it. And I'm fascinated by people who are serial entrepreneurs, people who like not serial start companies, but serially start successful companies. And that's a very, very short list. But those people I think we can learn the most from because they probably figured something out. And people are like, well, once you have money, like, no, people are much better at blowing, you know, even people who are bad business people who can get investors money are generally good at just blowing through money, not building sustainable things. But a guy like Warren Buffett, you know, who continuously has built almost a huge fortune, seems to be knowing what he's doing. You know, and I would argue that, you know, there are just a small number of examples of those people to learn from, but they're worth studying because they figured something out.
Yep.
Gentlemen, any picks, any recommendations?
I got a goofy pick. This week, Serious Sam came out on VR. For those of you guys who have the Vive, Serious Sam is back in VR.
That's my pick, too. I want to have a conversation about this because I made a realization about myself.
Oh, go ahead.
I don't know if I need this to be that serious. Like, I was literally like the second wave that you get in this game.
Wait, hold up. For those of us who are ignorant, can you explain to me what the hell we're talking about?
Serious Sam is a first-person shooter from the early 2000s, late 1990s. It sort of picked up the mantle that Duke Nukem 3D originally created with over-the-top, outrageous action, unrepentant, just, you know, insane blood and guts everywhere. This one, Serious Sam VR, they released a sort of an early release test version of it for $30. It's only the first two levels. However, it was the most fun I've had in VR, maybe in the last two months. It was amazing. I liked it quite a bit. It's just wave after wave of insane creatures coming at you. And the more of them you kill, the more money you make. And then you spend the money on better guns so that you could take on the next wave of them.
I was scared.
It was actually scary, right?
It's scary. I don't like it. Like, I realize that I don't like that. Like, oh, I,
dude,
the I, second wave. Well, number one, first person shooters just are not my bag. Like, right. They've never really been my bag. And I don't, I mean, like, I don't like them. In fact, it's part of the reason why when kind of I stopped playing video games, I so rarely kind of had the hook to get back in because by and large, the most popular are always FPS, right? On some level. So, you know, it was one of those things where it's like, at first it's like, it's cool. Then the second level is like you in the basement of like a pyramid where all you can see is like literally where you're looking, like as if you have like a minor
headlamp.
And it was like kind of terrifying. And you know, like it did its job in VR, man. Like it definitely brought you in to that basement. And there's definitely a lot of weird, creepy crawlies running and throwing fireballs at you and stuff like that. But this is the second level.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. And it's great though. Like very quickly you realize like whatever direction you look is where the light is, and it really does feel like you're wearing a miner hat. Bryce, you played this, right?
Yeah, I played through the first four levels, I think.
And what were your takeaways?
I played Raw Data earlier this year when it came out. And that scared the hell out of me because that's a full 360-degree shooting game. And it's got a lot of different systems, and you have to pick up the gun, you have to hold the gun, and reload the gun, and all this stuff. What I enjoyed a lot about Serious Sam is that it still had the very like visceral, like, oh, there are bad guys right in front of your face because you didn't look moments. But it's also a simpler and easier game and system to get into. So
yeah.
I think as an experience, it is way more approachable while still feeling very intense.
It also helps that they're only mainly coming from one direction, right?
Mean, the front 180.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. But like that is a terrifying thing when you turn around and realize you're being attacked from the other side.
Yeah.
It's fantastic though, man. Like I cannot wait.
This is early access.
It's only going to get better and better and better.
Yeah. And soon it will be the only thing. It'll be all around us. I have a pick. I'm pulling this up here to get the actual name of the authors. And this is a – I listened to this on Audible. Very, very interesting book. And it is Platform Revolution by Jeffrey G. Parker with Marshall W. Van Alstyne and Sangeel Paul Chaudhry. So it's basically getting into the idea of platforms and the idea of what is it, platforms as a business model. And you talk about, you know, Uber, Airbnb, Amazon, PayPal, et cetera, how they're platforms where kind of other people come together and that's sort of the function of what they do. You know, Uber at this point doesn't own cars. Uber helps is a platform for you using your car to make money providing services to other people. Airbnb, same thing. And then it's just the idea of how much of this is sort of the biggest businesses now tend to be platforms. Platforms are where other people come together and do that. So it's been a very interesting book. And I've been listening that to they get into too, like you realize too that how Uber and Airbnb kind of got to where they were by breaking laws, you know, which is sort of an interesting point, or pushing their people who use the platform to break laws. And this is sort of approach from the kind of you get these economists sort of talking about how, you know, part of like there's a hidden cost to Airbnb is that if you have somebody does damage to your house under Airbnb, but you have a homeowner's policy and you use that to pay out, everybody else, you know, every other person who pays in that policy is actually paying for that. And you're kind of committing basically a you're lying or whatever. You're abusing that sort of system to do that.
It sounds like soft fraud. You're not buying business insurance. You're using a homeowner's policy, which is not intended for a commercial business.
Yeah, and I mean it's a minor point, but it does get into sometimes how you push these sort of externalities or external costs elsewhere, whatever, which is an interesting point of view. But I mean, I you know, you think about like, you know, Airbnb is frustrating in a lot of cities. People don't want it because you have people who live in apartments and they don't want complete strangers who've never been vetted by, you know, the apartment board coming in there and staying there. And they're uncomfortable with that sort of aspect to it. So it deals with, I thought it was good that it talked about those aspects to it instead of just a, isn't this all around awesome? It's like, well, there are these other things taking place. But you also understand like why Airbnb is such an amazing, successful company in many ways, or could be, is that if they want to add 500 more hotel rooms, they can do that tomorrow. If you're Hilton or you're Marriott, you can't add 500 new room capacity overnight. And this is sort of the value of platforms, is platforms can expand at these incredibly big rates.
So, right.
Thought it was a very good overview and understanding of kind of like how platforms work and the value to them. So I listened to it on Audible.
Right on. I'm going to buy it right this very minute.
But yeah. Anyhow, gentlemen, it's been after.
Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.